thanks very much for joining me again.
I'm James Curran. I'm Professor of Modern History here at Sydney University and also the International Editor at the Australian Financial Review, where I write regularly about Australia in world affairs.
Well, as promised, in the last episode, we're going to talk today about Australia and the Asian national independence movements in the Cold War era. That issue, which above all else dominated Australian defence and foreign policy during the 1950s and 1960s, the height of the Cold War. It's in this period that the Southeast Asia, which we know today, assumed the essentials of its present shape. As the former defence bureaucrat Paul Dibb stated in his landmark 1986 report on Australian defence, the region immediately to the north of Australia was of first importance for national security, for it's from this region or through this region that any attack on Australia might come. Australian policymakers in this era understood this well, and it was to the problems of the transition that they devoted most of their creative energies. They quickly grasped that the national independence movements were remaking the geopolitical and geocultural character of their neighbourhood. Australian leaders recognised that they would not be able to take these newly independent nations for granted. These peoples were no longer to be colonies under the control of distant empires. The changes which were wrought throughout the region gave political mastery to the peoples themselves, who embarked on the process of nation building. The results of this process were unpredictable. The new states were unstable, often rent by internal divisions. Nevertheless, it was these nations which were to determine the future shape of the region. Whatever the outcome in each case, this was the new world with which Australia had to learn to live. Thus evident why Australian governments and their advisers gave this nationalist revolution and its consequences top priority. Looking out on the world of the 1950s, Australia took it for granted that Britain and America had charge of Western interests in Europe and the Middle East, and that the Americans were responsible for containing the Sino-Soviet bloc in Northeast Asia, Korea and Japan. In Southeast Asia, however, which was Australia's immediate neighbourhood, where it had direct and primary interests, interests which were in some fundamental respects different from those of its great and powerful friends, the situation was much more fluid and uncertain. Britain and America had different perspectives on the region. Britain was involved in Southeast Asia as a legacy of its imperial past. It approached the region from the west. British interest in the region was an extension of its interest in the Suez Canal and India. Americans, however, approached the region from the east, drawn by its confrontation with communist China and the Soviet Union. For them, Southeast Asia was a subsidiary part of the China problem. Australians, on the other hand, viewed Southeast Asia longitudinally, not latitudinally. For them, it was their northern border, their very near north, as Robert Menzies said in 1939. As a result, Australian governments developed objectives and policies of their own for the region and tried to manoeuvre the British and the Americans to serve their purposes. Now, it may be questioned whether the Australian policies were wise, especially Australia's intervention in the Vietnam War. But there is no question that the Australian government, in responding to the great changes in the region, adopted distinctive stands which were intended to safeguard Australia's peculiar interests in those changes. Therefore, just as the Americans and British gave first priority to the global Cold War, consigning Southeast Asia to a peripheral role, so Australia was happy to leave the global issues to the Americans and British and focus their energies on the near north. While like the Americans and the British, the Australians were troubled by the spread of worldwide communism, they were more broadly concerned about the reordering of the region and the form that it would ultimately take. Those Asian regimes which were communist, most notably the People's Republic of China, were depicted in the language of dread. Instead of the yellow peril, Australia now feared red China, which was demonised in political debates and the mainstream media. You remember Gough Whitlam on one occasion talking about yellow lava, as he put it. For non-communist Southeast Asians, such as the Philippines, Malaysia, and most important of all, Indonesia, Australia adopted a new language, language of neighbourliness. Richard Casey, who was External Affairs Minister for most of the 1950s, wrote a book at the end of his term in office about these nations, and he called the book Near Neighbours. Now, for white Australia policy was still in place, this was quite a new approach to the region. Previously, the strong powers like Japan had been treated with respect but with no pretense of friendship, while the weak and colonised had been despised or pitied. With these non-communist states, Australia from the outset had tried to establish a relationship on the basis of being a good neighbour. That is, by using a language of equality and intimacy. Now, to illustrate Australia's response to Southeast Asia, I'm going to look at the two major problems associated with the national independence movements. I'm going to look at the Indonesian struggle for independence and the fate of West New Guinea. And secondly, I'm going to look at the Indonesian confrontation with Malaysia over the future of the British territories in Borneo, Sarawak, and British North Borneo. Now, in a later episode, I will look also at the communist-led Vietnamese nationalist movement and the Vietnam War. The issue is, however, that these latter two problems, confrontation and the Vietnam War, become so intertwined that they more or less have to be dealt with together. So they will be dealt with in a future episode. To illustrate Australia's response to Southeast Asia, I shall in this episode look at one of the major problems associated with the national independence movements, and that is Indonesian struggle for independence and the fate of West New Guinea. In a future episode, I will look at the Indonesian confrontation with Malaysia over the future of the British territories in Borneo, and I'll also look at the communist-led Vietnamese nationalist movement and the Vietnam War. But those two problems, confrontation and Vietnam, become so intertwined that they more or less have to be dealt with together. So let's move to Indonesian independence and West New Guinea. Now, the essence of the point to grasp here for listeners is that Australia's relations with Indonesia are totally different from its relations with the rest of Asia. Now, this is because on virtually all other questions to do with the region, Australia in this period aligned itself with the stance of its great and powerful friends, Great Britain and the United States. But on Indonesia, there was a fundamental difference of views and interests. Australia had therefore to develop its own distinctive policy arising out of its own circumstances. And it's therefore worth noting that Australia never demonised Indonesia in the same way as it demonised China and Japan in other periods. For Australia, Indonesia's emergence as an independent state was the most important result of the nationalist movements. It was, of all the Southeast Asian nations, the largest in population, around 10 times the size of Australia, and it contained great natural resources. Furthermore, it's poised on Australia's northern frontier, geographically linking Australia to Asia. Now, the Australian government at the end of the Second World War had not anticipated the rise of the Asian national independence movements. In its planning for the post-war world, it simply expected the European empires to come back to the region. But when, at the end of the war, nationalists in what was known then as the Dutch East Indies made it clear that they were not willing to welcome back their Dutch masters and were prepared to carry on an armed struggle to prevent it, Australia at first took a cautious approach. They were worried by the prospect of instability and hoped the nationalists would be reasonable and accept self-government inside the Dutch Empire. But as it became clear that the Dutch would not make any concessions and the Indonesians hardened their own position, Australia wisely saw the advisability of coming to terms with the Indonesian demands. Unlike the Americans and the British, who were primarily concerned not to offend the Dutch because London and Washington, the Dutch, were important for the Western Union in Europe, the Australians understood that the nationalist movement must eventually succeed and that Australia would in the future, unlike the British and the Americans, be living in close proximity to the new Indonesian state. Australia won the Indonesians' confidence and the nationalists appointed Australia their representative on a United Nations Good Offices Committee which was to try to reach a settlement. By late 1948, when the East-West tensions had reached a critical point in Europe, Dr. Evatt was gravely concerned that the Indonesian nationalists might be taken over by the communists unless speedy action was taken to force the Dutch to concede. Unless this was done, he told the British Prime Minister Clement Attlee,
Russia might spread onto that area as she had done in Europe.
And with that, the Americans were won over. They brought pressure to bear on the Dutch, and in December 1949, Indonesia achieved its independence. Now, though Indonesia gained independence with Australian goodwill and support, and thereby Australia was able to establish its relationship with the new nation on a sound footing, there was an outstanding problem which was for a decade to cast a shadow over this otherwise auspicious beginning. That was the future of West New Guinea, or, as the Indonesians refer to it, Irian Jaya. The peace settlement had left that question unresolved. The Indonesians, as the successor state to the Dutch East Indies, claimed sovereignty. They maintained it should become part of their new republic. The Dutch, encouraged by the Australians, would not surrender it. It was their last foothold in the region. The Menzies government referred publicly to the ethnic differences between the indigenous inhabitants of West New Guinea and those of Indonesia. The External Affairs Department, in explaining Australia's opposition, said that
Netherlands New Guinea, that is WNG, occupies a special position geographically, ethnologically, and politically. It is the only foreign territory whose land frontier confronts our own, and it occupies a strategic position in relation to the Torres Straits and the North Australian coastline generally.
On this question, there was a bipartisan Australian policy. The Menzies government indeed carried the implications of the already enunciated position to quite extreme lengths. Almost as soon as Percy Spender assumed the office of External Affairs Minister, he informed the Dutch that Australia considered itself a party principal in the matter, in other words, a major player, and that no change in West New Guinea's status should take place without its consent. If the Dutch did not wish to keep the colony, then they should relinquish the territory to Australia because, he said,
Australia had a far better claim than any other nation.
Indeed, Spender feared that if the Indonesians were not stopped from taking Dutch New Guinea, their next step might be to target Australian New Guinea. And when he spoke at The Hague in 1950, he said that
Australia has a deep attachment to the people of Australian New Guinea, an attachment which was cemented during the Japanese War when they fought and suffered together and succoured one another. If the claim of Indonesia to Dutch New Guinea were conceded to any degree at all, it would be but a matter of time, no matter how genuine may be assurances to the contrary, when the claim will be pushed further so as to include the trust territory of Australian New Guinea and its people. Experience has shown to Australians how strategically vital to Australian defence is the mainland of New Guinea. I have pointed out before that we cannot alter our geography, which for all time makes this idea of supreme consequence to Australia.
He went on.
Quite apart from its military and strategic significance, one cannot disregard the ever-increasing communist pressure in Asia. Communism has not got any foothold yet in Australian New Guinea. Australia is determined, insofar as it can, to ensure that it will not.
A 1955 cabinet decision set out the reasons for Australian support for the Dutch, which was because
A. That legally their sovereignty is clearly established. B. That they make a good neighbour for our own territories in eastern New Guinea. And C. That it is desirable in the interests of Australia's own defence that West New Guinea should be in the hands of a non-communist government. Indonesia is non-communist, but we cannot be sure that it will not, in the course of time, come into the communist orbit.
Simultaneously, Indonesia had begun an international campaign to pressure the Dutch to cede the territory. The acquisition of West New Guinea became for the Indonesians a powerful national cause. It would be the final act in ridding the region of the Dutch Empire. It would be the final step in the completion of their great state. Indonesian action stirred the Australians to greater efforts. Australia wooed their great and powerful friends, hoping that they would use their influence to block the Indonesians. To show how serious the Australian government was, Spender told the British that Australia was prepared to go to war to prevent Indonesia acquiring West New Guinea. And he said that if the United Nations intervened on the side of the Indonesians, he said it would mean a
break between Australia and the UN.
But neither the United States nor Britain would assist Australia. They did not wish to do anything which might alienate the Indonesian nationalists, which might strengthen the position of the Indonesian Communist Party. And since the Dutch made it clear to the Australians that they were not going to leave, the Australians had no option but to soften their approach and accept the Anglo-American advice to put the issue into cold storage. That is, they favoured leaving matters as they were, hoping in due course that Indonesia would give up the cause or that the Dutch would, after a reasonable period of tutelage, give independence to West New Guinea or that some other satisfactory solution might appear. But at all costs, they wanted to keep the issue out of the United Nations, since increasing numbers of Asian and African members were changing the political balance in a direction that was favourable to Indonesia. During the whole decade of the 1950s, Australia invested enormous diplomatic resources in trying to ensure that Indonesia could not muster the numbers necessary to put the matter on the agenda of the General Assembly in New York. But the issue did not go away. Indonesia was rent by internal divisions. Parliamentary government only seemed to contribute to instability and lack of confidence in the country. And so President Sukarno in 1956 decided that Western-style democracy was not the Indonesian way. And so he replaced party government with guided democracy. Focusing all power in his own office, he formed governments of national unity representing all the major political forces of the country, his own national party, the armed forces, the Muslims and the communists. But this reform did little to address the chronic economic and social problems. As a result, Sukarno increasingly focused public attention on the nationalist issue of West New Guinea. And in 1958, as punishment for their refusal to hand over West New Guinea, confiscated the remaining assets of the Dutch and threatened military action. This more aggressive Indonesian posture disturbed the Australians greatly. They were on the horns of a dilemma. On the one hand, the Australians, like the Dutch, could expect little, if any, help from Britain or the United States in a final showdown, so they were inclined to look for a diplomatic way out. On the other hand, they considered West New Guinea to be so vital to their security that they felt obliged to give thought to how it should be defended against an Indonesian takeover. In 1959, the Australian government tried to head off what might otherwise become a grave crisis. So they invited the Indonesian Foreign Minister Subandrio to Canberra to discuss Indonesia's actions and intentions. The Indonesian Foreign Minister wished to allay fears about Indonesia sharing a border with Australia, which the annexation of West New Guinea would involve. He said, "There's no reason for alarm. Indonesia's history of living in harmony with neighbouring countries like British Borneo and Portuguese Timor showed that Indonesia could live peacefully with other powers." Subandrio also asked that Australia state publicly that it would not block a peaceful transfer of West New Guinea to Indonesia, implication being that this sort of statement from Canberra would strengthen Indonesia's links with the West and enhance its ability to oppose the growth of Chinese influence. Furthermore, he added that the failure to make such a statement would be tantamount to giving tacit support to the Indonesian Communist Party. Now, though the Australians were not convinced by these soft words, as a gesture of goodwill, they told the Indonesian minister that they would recognise any settlement of the question between the parties which was arrived at by peaceful means. In other words, Australia was no longer claiming to be a party principal. They would accept any outcome, including the cession of West New Guinea to Indonesia, provided it came about peacefully. Now, that was, in a way, anticipating the inevitable end. But the Australian government came under sustained attack in the press, the parliament and the public for having softened its policy. Even the Labor Party, though it was content to hear the Indonesian Foreign Minister talk about the Chifley Labor government of the late 1940s as the midwife of Indonesian independence, the Labor Party had no support for the Indonesian cause on West New Guinea. Evatt had previously termed Jakarta's claim as
frivolous and indefensible.
Others attacked the government for its sellout and likened the capitulation to the 1938 Munich settlement with Hitler. As historian Peter Edwards has argued, there was agreement across the political spectrum on total opposition to the Indonesian claim, from the left of the ALP to the Democratic Labour Party and the RSL. Only the communists disagreed. Nevertheless, Indonesia's decision to embark on a guerrilla war against the Dutch was deeply disturbing. As a result, and this is fascinating, in the middle of 1959, the Defence Committee of Cabinet, on the advice of the Departments of Defence, Joint Chiefs and External Affairs, conceived a new defence policy, namely that the Australian Defence Forces should be
designed primarily with the ability to act independently of allies.
With their eyes on Indonesian truculence, they maintained that there were a number of possibilities in which Australia might have to act alone, that is, without its great power protectors. And these possibilities included conflict with Indonesia over West New Guinea, and even
limited war with Indonesia while US and other allies were engaged elsewhere.
Now, this is deeply significant. This proposal from the Defence Committee of Cabinet represents a break with all the post-1950 defence doctrine, which assumed that Australia would only be at war as an ally of the United States and Britain. It reflected Australian policymakers' concerns that if Indonesia did attempt to seize West New Guinea by force, and if Canberra decided to resist that action, he would have no choice but to act alone. Now, did the proposal get anywhere? No. In Cabinet, Menzies, on the advice of his department, rejected the recommendation. He still held to the belief that Australia's power was so limited that it had no choice but to be a subordinate partner, in particular to the US, and therefore any independent action was out of the question. Now, the Indonesians were in no way appeased by Australia's diplomatic concessions. If anything, Australia's more reasonable position tended to encourage the Indonesians to press ahead, and they raised the pressure. President Sukarno took personal control of the military campaign, and an increasing number of Indonesian guerrillas were dispatched to West New Guinea. At this point, the Americans intervened. The Kennedy administration, which had taken office in 1961, decided, against the backdrop of the intensifying Cold War, that they could not let this sore continue to fester. It's important to note here that for most of the 1950s, the Americans had adopted a policy of neutrality in relation to the Dutch-Indonesian dispute, and they had accordingly abstained in the principal votes in the UN. Nevertheless, gradually towards the end of the decade, Washington had come around to sharing the view put forward by the Indonesian Foreign Minister Subandrio, that a friendly Indonesia incorporating West New Guinea would be far more valuable to the West than to have West New Guinea in friendly hands, but next to a hostile, perhaps communist Indonesia. Now, Sukarno's hold on government was a fine balancing act, and the Americans feared that if he did not get his way over West New Guinea, then the Indonesian Communist Party might seize the leadership of the national cause and possibly overthrow Sukarno. In other words, they saw him as a nationalist that should be supported against the communist forces in Indonesia. As one of Kennedy's key advisers, Robert Comer, known as Blowtorch Bob, put it, it's worth sacrificing
a few thousand square miles of cannibal land.
So Washington pressed the Dutch, who'd grown weary of the cost and aggravation, into giving up the territory. The Australians were informed only after the deals had been done. The UN was formally to take charge for 6 months. That's a face-saving gesture for the Dutch. The territory was then to be handed over to the Indonesians, who were to hold a plebiscite in 1969 to confirm that the people of West New Guinea approved of the Indonesian takeover. In May 1963, the Indonesians assumed control and, in 1969, reported that a plebiscite, which was a sham exercise, had overwhelmingly approved the incorporation of West New Guinea into Indonesia. In Australia, there was a great outburst of public indignation at this resolution of the West New Guinea problem. Labor leader Arthur Corwell, for example, used language similar to Spender in his 1962 call for the government to resist Indonesian aggression. But he also added what was becoming a very familiar post-World War II refrain.
If Indonesia seizes WNG by aggression, why should it not look greedily? First perhaps at Timor, then at PNG, and finally, who is to say, at Northern Australia. Are the lessons of history so soon forgotten? Hitler said he had no more territorial ambitions when he gobbled up Czechoslovakia. Or Neville Chamberlain believed him and talked of peace with honour. We all know what happened within a year.
Menzies, speaking in the Parliament in March 1962, conceded that Australia had to defer to the views of its great and powerful friends, and so he went about preparing the country to acquiesce in the Indonesian annexation of West New Guinea. He argued that the Labor position of transferring your burden to the UN, he said, is no policy at all.
When it comes to peace or war in this part of the world, where Great Britain and the US stand is of vital moment to this country. According to honourable members opposite, this is old-fashioned stuff. In their view, we should not be interested in what he describes as power blocks. Thank God we have a power block in this world. It will be a poor day for Australia if, in the name of some theoretical idea about the United Nations, we abandon our lines of communication with, to repeat my own phrase, our great and powerful friends. No country in the world more than ours needs great and powerful friends. I am all for them. I believe that the people of Australia are for them, and I believe that any policy pursued by us, which would put at risk our friendship with those countries, would be rejected by every sensible person in the country.
Thus, the Commonwealth Government, having been presented with a fait accompli, had no choice but to make the best of it. Two general points may be made about this affair in closing. Firstly, for Australia, it raised doubts about the meaning of the ANZUS alliance, about Australia's ability to rely on America either for support or even consultation about issues which touched its vital interests in the region. Secondly, for Indonesia, as was to prove the case in its subsequent annexation of East Timor, it may be that, as with the old European empires, Indonesia would find that its colonisation of West New Guinea would become a very heavy and costly burden. Nevertheless, what must be added too is that relations between Canberra and Jakarta remained remarkably cool and restrained in spite of the differences over foreign policy. This is probably explicable by Indonesia's desire not to jeopardise relations with Australia over a relatively unimportant issue. In other words, Sukarno's strongly anti-imperialist stance did not colour his views of the question, since, as the historian Jim Angel pointed out, Papua New Guinea did not represent a colonial base from which the larger threat of imperialism might arise. Australia was too small a power. Sukarno would have been much more worried about the serious and urgent imperialist threats such as the Dutch in West New Guinea and the British in Malaysia. Except for differences over West New Guinea, and as we'll see in the next episode, confrontation, the two countries continue to preserve cordial relations. They wanted to remain good neighbours, and there continue to be frequent interchanges at ministerial and officials level. Australia's Colombo Plan aid to Indonesia continued, which showed the extent to which Australia wanted to keep a spirit of goodwill in the relationship. But in closing, despite the fact that the gulf between Australia and America on this question of West New Guinea was wide, this was still the era in which Australia moved ever closer to the US on defence and economic issues. Thanks again for listening.
I would also like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples for over 60,000 years who lived on, loved and dreamt about the lands on which I am speaking today, and I pay my respects to their present and future successors who continue to embody their affection for Australia and their enthusiasm for its well-being. This series is produced by Peter Adams for the School of Humanities at the University of Sydney.